At the end of every WGTD midday newscast, we feature a song by a local artist. So please join us for Noon Tunes, Monday through Friday, 12:20 p.m., here on WGTD HD.
This is WGTD HD, serving Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that explores and highlights various local issues and organizations. It's hosted by Jane Herring, a former marketing manager at Gateway Technical College, Jenny Tunkies, former reporter for the Kenosha News, and a former chief of staff for the Kenosha County Executive, Marcia Connett, who is a Southeast Regional Consultant for Wisconsin Literacy, and she provides literacy education support and management expertise, and Xander Miller, a librarian at the Kenosha Public Library who also works on technology and digital skills. Community Matters also shares its time slot with the 30-time award-winning WGTD Radio Theater. And now, here's today's program.
Hello and welcome to WGTD's Community Matters. I'm your host this week, Xander Miller. I am once again sitting down with Rob Nunez. Rob, I spoke with around 6 months ago. Rob, how are you doing since then?
I'm doing good, Xander. Today's Friday, at least when we're recording. So I do not work this weekend, so I am in a very good mood right now.
All right. That's good to hear. And so I mentioned it's been about 6 months since I last interviewed you. We were talking about the sci-fi networks and the fiber lines that have been going down across the city because there's been a lot of construction, kind of groundwork, putting those lines in. Mm-hmm. It's been going ongoing for, I want to say, almost a year now. It's been only, 8-ish so months.
About 8 months or so, yeah. I was looking at the map of where the installation has been, and they have covered quite a bit of ground when you really think about how they're doing the installation, doing the micro trenching and on the different areas of the grass there, and they've reached all the way up to 45th Street, going as far west as 69th Avenue, and then as far south as 78th Street there. So they've covered quite a bit when you really think about it. Of course, there's that's some of the areas that they've completed. They're still working on additional areas right now. The information I'm pulling from, anyone can really also take a look at, and I would actually encourage people to, just kind of see how it is. There's an interactive map off the City of Kenosha's public works project site. I know the library does link to it off its homepage, so you can always take a look there and see what's going on.
Yeah, so yeah, they're making great progress putting those down, essentially. So we knew before there is a lot going on, and just we talked about generally what's going on, how it happened, all that. But it's been about 6 months. Mm-hmm. What's happened since then, or what's changed over time?
We also have the selection of the internet service provider, which is T-Mobile. So they're branding as T-Fiber right now. The T-Mobile is the first internet service provider to utilize this infrastructure. I believe they have I forgot how many year, but I know they have a few-year exclusivity agreement. Then afterwards, additional ISPs will be brought online to be able to utilize this network. So it's not just going to be T-Mobile exclusive only going forward. There will actually be some competition further on in the future. T-Mobile has yet to publicly release pricing. So that right now we can only go off of what we've seen with other municipalities that have used it. They have released, though, their speeds. So they will have three different tiers. There's going to be a 2 gigabit, a 1 gigabit, and a 500 megabit. connection speeds there with the 1 gigabit is what they're saying right now. At least marketing wise, they're claiming it's going to be the best value, best bang for the buck.
Okay. So how does I mean, T-Mobile's a massive, usually cell network company. Yes. So how, from what you know, how did T-Mobile even get involved in this process of all of that?
That is a good question. So I was actually talking with our T-Mobile rep not that long ago, because I'm finding out T-Mobile, at least from a business and from their what they do with business-to-business sales there, they do more than just cell phones and text messaging, Internet of Things, devices there. They have drone delivery and some smart city initiatives going on there, self-driving vehicle capabilities where they've deployed a couple of these in different shipyards, things like that. So I've always reach out and I'm just curious, like, you know, what can they offer that to help us possibly reduce costs in certain areas, possibly renegotiate out licensing, things like they also will oversee our Google apps because we use Google Workspace for email and document management here at the library. So, you know, maybe it would be cheaper to go with them than our current vendor that we go through. So, I'm always in talks with to try and make sure we spend the money as best we can. So, where this wound up coming from, because that was one of the questions too that I wound up asking our rep of where this came from. And apparently as part of the Sprint merger, so T-Mobile several years back did buy out Sprint, which was the, one was the third and one was the fourth. I know they switched places quite a bit, ranking-wise, largest cell phone network provider in the United States. So when they bought Sprint out, they also brought with them some other network infrastructure that allowed them to be able to manage and maintain fiber networks. And Kenosha is going to be, I believe, one of the first cities, if not the first city, to be lit up under what they're calling T-Fiber. There are several others, a couple in Colorado, a couple of areas around the Twin Cities area in Minnesota, I believe one city out in New York as well, that will have that will eventually have this T-Fiber as their service provider here. And similar situations where it's this massive installation of fiber going down and now they need someone to light it up and be able to help the patron or be able to help the citizens, the residents of that community be able to utilize it.
Yeah. So let me make sure I'm getting this right. So T-Mobile, you know, when they merged with Sprint, they got a lot more infrastructure to mm-hmm. use to support different like initiatives for connectivity, so mm-hmm. beyond just being a cell phone company. And so getting them here, the idea right now is that T-Mobile is going to have exclusivity with the fiber lines for a while. Not sure, you know, how long, but for some time.
Yeah.
Then they're going to be managing them mm-hmm. over time, essentially.
Yep.
Okay. So I guess my question, we don't know pricing yet, is because it's an exclusivity for a while, how do you think that's going to play out with like Spectrum and AT&T in the area? Because I know when we talk about networking right now, mm-hmm. Spectrum or AT&T are usually the one, or not, yeah, Spectrum or AT&T, the ones people talk about. And when I say talk, it's usually complain.
Yeah.
Because prices go up, they have such a high control over what's in the city that they kind of do whatever they want and don't care.
Yeah.
So how's T-Mobile going to be different while they have exclusivity for a while?
I do. Also just want to say, too, that, you know, I've been to a couple of the community conversations from the Building Our Future and internet and access has come up in the past. And one of the things that winds up coming out of those conversations is a lot of complaints about the current providers in the area. They're too expensive, speeds are too slow, things along those lines are the main complaints there. So I think what you're going to wind up seeing in the long run is with this additional competition, the basics of capitalism being shown here of, you know, you're going to have more people being able to provide a similar product. The price will go down. Hopefully, too, we'll see quality of customer service and quality of the network speeds thing. And customer service, like I said, go up. So you'll hopefully be able to see some better customer satisfaction in the long run, knowing that you can go from one vendor to another, and it's not going to really cost you that much, if anything at all. One thing I was seeing too, and you're starting to see this more and more with various vendors out there, between cell phones, but also internet service providers, of going with a month-to-month option instead of having to sign a one-year, two-year contract with them, and being locked in with them and potentially have seeing your prices go up. So you have that flexibility then to be able to jump off and go to somewhere else if you so choose. There are, of course, you know, other complications, say, with that, having to, you know, change out your equipment, and if you're heavily relying on the internet service provider's email address for your email, then you're switching from one address to the next type deal, in which case I would encourage people to really look at the other options that are out there between, you know, there's Yahoo, there's AOL still, there's Gmail, which of course is like one of the most popular ones that's out there, but of course Microsoft's Live, Outlook, or whatever they're calling it now. Unfortunately, they do change their name quite often. There are various other options out there. Of course, there's also the more privacy-focused options. If you have a Apple device, you automatically get the iCloud and the .dot. I believe it's still a .dot iCloud email address. And then there's also other services out there like Proton. That's also more privacy-focused as well.
Yeah. That actually, this brings up a interesting point. As you know, folks do use like Spectrum's email systems or something mm-hmm. along those lines. It brings up the idea that they like bundling
yeah.
a lot of the services that they can offer.
Mm-hmm.
Will these fiber lines be used for anything else aside from internet? Would there potentially be bundling options, since, you know, T-Mobile's kind of phone company? Would they also be able to do phone plans bundled in with that?
Nothing's been publicly released yet. We've seen with Google Fiber, because Google does also offer its own internet service, and other cities around the country, of yes, you can actually have television signals pushed over these lines as well. So yes, they do have agreements just like any other cable company with other services. Of course, it being Google, they eventually started trying to provide people with more of a YouTube type experience in the long run. So I believe that's where they wound up going, actually, was to some sort of like a YouTube YouTube Live or YouTube channels type setup there, and you had a Chromecast or a Chromebox on your television instead of having to rely on a traditional TV receiver or anything along those lines. In short, it's possible for them, but we haven't seen anything publicly available yet.
Okay. Yeah, that's one of the things with having so little competition for a while, is that you get very entrenched mm-hmm. into that system, and then changing it becomes harder and harder yeah. and harder. But the idea that even if you know it's going to be T-Mobile exclusive for a while, mm-hmm. It's still another party to potentially choose from.
Yes.
It's kind of a lot of what I'm getting out of that. And T-Mobile has been, you know, you've worked with T-Mobile before as part of with the library, and so it, from your experience, fairly reliable for just service as a whole?
Pretty reliable, I'd say, for service. Just to note that the library doesn't just exclusively utilize T-Mobile. We also have Verizon access as well for their cellular network for data. That's primarily utilized in our outreach or bookmobile department, wherever listeners wind up seeing the bookmobile, book truck, or Wi-Fi van that goes out. They are utilizing a Verizon network as well. And then T-Mobile is primarily used for our patron hotspot lending program at this point. Their cell phone network has been powering us for a number of years, even prior to the pandemic when we were received federal funding to expand that program out temporarily.
Okay. Yeah, so multiple networks to work with. That's good. You're kind of almost implementing some form of competition in there. It's like, yeah, you could always switch if they're not treated well. So something that we had talked about months ago is, like, when do people potentially get started with the networks? And you mentioned they've been making great progress with the spread of the fiber lines throughout the city. And I think, if I'm remembering correctly here, you'd said potentially people might be able to start, like, almost December, like, in those first areas, something like that.
Sometime soon.
Sometime soon.
Sometime soon. So off the Fiber City website, there is the ability to sign up to learn more about the network, and that'll actually direct you over to a T-Mobile or T-Fiber portal there for Kenosha that allows listeners to enter their email address, and they'll receive updates of when T-Fiber is becoming available in different areas. And that's something I would actually encourage people to do if they are interested, so that way they can see what the updates are, when installation is going to be happening, and then also not just installation, I should say, of T-Fiber, but also of the fiber lines potentially being pushed down in their area. But then also, being able to hopefully sign up and possibly be some of the first customers if they want to choose to be so, or if they want to wait for others to test the network out and get the waters tested, that's not a bad idea as well.
Yeah, so sometime soon is probably as official it's going to get until, oh, it's here.
Yeah.
as they do. And so, yeah, that's honestly, some people might have access maybe later this year, maybe 2024, who knows.
Yes.
The idea, though, is that sometime soon we're going to start seeing the first wave of people who can adopt this new network. What would you expect as potential hiccups in the first few uses of it? Because you mentioned it, you know, you might want to wait until someone else is using it and see what they think. That sounded like there might be some hiccups potentially. And it's a new network, a new fiber lines. There's bound to be something, right?
Oh, there's going to be some small bugs here and there that they have to work out of the system. The equipment they're using is enterprise grade. It is something that's been heavily tested in lab conditions. And the one thing that I have told staff before here that ask, well, why are we set stuff up this way, and this way, and not use it this other way that you might use it at home or have it configured if you're doing a Microsoft certification exam or something like that. Those are ideal conditions. And we don't always have those kinds of ideal conditions in the real world, air quotes around real world there, because yes, we all live in the real world, we're not in the Matrix. But what we have is when you start seeing additional traffic, when you start possibly having to worry about any kind of cyber attack, cybersecurity there, people doing things on the network that you weren't fully expecting them to, then you have to start, okay, we got to figure out how can we protect ourselves? How can we make sure things are fine? And then there's always just the occasional random issues that you might find. An example that I like to throw out there is, when you install an electrical outlet in your house, the positive is supposed to go on one side and the neutral is supposed to go on the other side, right, of an outlet. Well, sometimes if you're like me and you pull open the outlet, you might see that they're accidentally flipped. So you have to, sometimes little things like that can happen. A small configuration change might need to happen on a piece of equipment where it's literally a checkbox or a very quick command that has to be fired off on the piece to ensure that balanced network stability and traffic is properly balanced there as well. Then there's also just the unfortunate extreme disasters that you might wind up seeing happening. I'm sure they have proper protection at their data centers and the network hubs there to be able to protect against electrical outages and power surges and things like that. But there's always something that can somehow sneak through all of that. It's one in 1 millionth plus of a possibility, but it can happen.
Yeah, I'd imagine that these fiber lines are going to be tested come winter.
Oh, yes.
Because sometimes in Kenosha, it's just a bad weather day, and everyone's Wi-Fi is knocked out that day.
Yeah.
It happens. So I imagine one of the first things is going to be, well, if they start in winter, how bad is winter going to affect these lines? They're in the ground, but still.
Yeah, and on paper, everything should operate just fine. But on paper versus reality can sometimes be two slightly different things.
Yeah, but it's also like same thing happens with Spectrum and AT&T. Yeah. They just get knocked out sometimes.
Yeah.
The speed of the restoration is usually the quality we rate them by when that happens rather than it's going to happen.
Yeah.
And fiber lines don't really, there could be some of the same issues essentially. Mm-hmm. So I do want to talk about, cause you mentioned that there might be security hiccups with even the fiber lines. I would have imagined that each of those are kind of separate, like when someone's on a network, that their network isn't going to affect everyone else who's using the same fiber lines. Is that not necessarily the case?
Oh, that should be the case, where everyone's going to have their own separate areas, own separate sub-networks, really. So you're going to have the greater overall network that's spread throughout the city, and then inside your house, you'll have your own separate isolated network where you can get a virus, and traditional viruses spread via email or someone clicking on a bad link. So it should be isolated to within your area or within your friends group that gets emailed out and not spread throughout the rest of the network. That was an issue that I know that we had to worry about in the very early days of DSL and cable high-speed networks, of things spreading out just over the network constantly, and that's really been fixed now for a number of years.
If you're just tuning in with us, this is WGTD's Community Matters with your host, Xander Miller. I've been talking to Rob Nunez about the fiber lines coming through with the city updates, T-Mobile as the official first provider on there. They'll have exclusivity for a while. But we started talking about security in those fiber lines, and you mentioned that the security should, there really nothing should come from the fiber lines that really affects you when dropping. It's usually something that has come in on your end that would affect something, not necessarily the network itself.
Yes.
That's right?
Oh, unfortunately, yes. It is, working IT for a number of years, we referred to everyone that uses a computer as a user or a end user of sorts. Usually whenever there is some sort of cybersecurity matter there, we do have, it's usually someone clicking on a link or opening an email that they shouldn't have, opening an email attachment that they shouldn't have. A lot of our providers for email do have filters set up, but doesn't mean everything doesn't get caught. There's always going to be something there, or you know, you don't update your version of Windows that you're running, or whatever operating system it is, be it Windows, Google Chrome, Apple, Linux. You know, there's always some sort of vulnerability out there that can be exploited, unfortunately.
Yeah, let's talk about this, because with a whole network coming in, a whole new provider, people are going to be more connected. And one of the things that I you know, talk to people a lot about is their own security with computers, networks, whatever the case. And it's always really hard to talk about a lot of these concepts of security and users and clicking on stuff when everything wants you to click on it.
Yeah.
So what are some things that people need to be aware of for their security once they're connected and on the internet?
Well, the first thing is always make sure that your operating system or whatever device that you're utilizing is fully up to date. That does vary from operating system to operating system. Traditionally, though, if you're on a Windows computer, you can go to the Start menu, type in Update. Windows Updates will be one of the first results that pop up that you can click on that and actually run Windows Updates. I should note too that Windows does also have its own antivirus built into it now, called Microsoft Defender or Windows Defender. I can't remember because they changed the name a couple of times on me. But that is a very basic antivirus. It catches a good chunk of things that are out there. But there are also other providers out there of antivirus. That's something that someone else can, I'm sure, provide a little bit more information on, because there's just so many different options out there. Mac is the same, some similar concept of you click on the little Apple in the upper left menu there, and you can do a system update from there. If you're running Linux, I trust you already know how to update your operating system. You're probably also troubleshooting your parent system as well.
What is updating an operating system actually do? Because, you know, they come up all the time. It's kind of annoying how much it can come up, but, like, what is that doing?
I know, and I'm just as guilty as anyone else of saying, snooze, please do this later, I'm too busy, I don't want to do it. So what this actually does is they apply security patches and also system enhancements to the device or system that you're running. So you're going to have new features coming down, but then there's also vulnerabilities that get patched. Microsoft notoriously has what they call Patch Tuesday, where they will release a bunch of software patches all at once. And these will fix what are known as zero-day vulnerabilities. So these are vulnerabilities that hackers have discovered or that has come to their attention through Microsoft's team of white hat hackers and outsourced individuals there that have found a vulnerability in Windows that allows it to be remotely accessed and controlled. And this is a patch to be able to seal that vulnerability up. One of the more notorious ones of these back when I was still in high school was the Blaster virus, and that was followed up the following year by the Sasser virus. Blaster ran havoc on Windows XP machines because it automatically it was able to get into your computer over a general internet connection, so you just had to be connected to the internet. So it was that big of a vulnerability in Windows, but then it would shut your computer down after 1 minute.
Oh.
Yeah, so this little countdown box came up, and it was actually exploiting a built-in function for Windows XP that was designed for network administrators to be able to remotely reboot computers, you know, at night during maintenance cycles, things like that, because as a network administrator, you're going to want to be able to push out an update or push out software, and usually after you push out a piece of software, you want to reboot the system so that any temporary files or anything crazy that might be in the memory or cached gets cleared out so that the user or the employee can have a better experience the following day.
Mm-hmm. And so updates stop stuff like that because they get noticed. They get pushed out. So even if it's something that, you know, hasn't affected you yet, it's preventing future effects that could happen.
Correct.
Okay. What other tips are there once people are, you know, connected? What else should they strive to be doing to keep themselves safe?
Always be wary of unsolicited emails. It's a practice that I've had to utilize for many, many years. So, you know, one thing that a hacker or anyone of malicious intent wants to try and do is they want you to click on that link in that email. So they're going to make that email look as official as they can. I have gotten ones that look so similar to various banking institutions, and really there's no banking institution that's really safe out there, because attackers will do is they'll just throw out ones for anyone and everyone and really try and get you to click on that link. Or I've seen things go out. I've actually received stuff myself for Geek Squad, for various other companies, large national retailers, Amazon, what have you, that try and get me to click on a link in the email or open up an attachment. And second that attachment loads, it actually will execute a little piece of code in the background that will then give a attacker the remote capability or remote access capability into your system there. Or when you click on the link, basically it's the same thing, that they're able to execute a little piece of code. So what's if you get an email with an attachment on it and it doesn't, and you didn't request the service or you didn't actually do any of those kinds of services like utilize Geek Squad, it's one of those, be very careful to, one, first off, just don't open the attachment. If you, especially if it's an invoice or something like that, you know you can go to the Geek Squad portal or into your Amazon account or any place else and log in there and actually look at any invoices or outstanding orders that you may have. If it's a bank, and what you can do too is actually hover over, put your mouse cursor over that link, and that won't actually execute the code, but you'll be able to see at the bottom there what the URL is that it's going to. Alternatively, you can do the exact same thing that I suggested doing for anyone trying to get you to open up an invoice or an attachment. You go to the official website that you know. So you go to your official, so say you got something for U.S. Bank and you do use U.S. Bank for banking purposes. You go straight to the banking website itself and log in there if you really want to be safe than sorry.
Okay, so some tips for email. It's like, you know, don't click things that you don't expect.
Yeah.
It's really the short of all of that. And there's one problem with this that I've seen or experienced, is that, you know, when you're signing up for a service of some sort,
mm-hmm.
like say, you know, you shop at Lowe's or something,
mm-hmm.
and they ask for your email, and then for communication purposes, and now I'm getting a bunch of emails from Lowe's or someone affiliated with them. And, you know, sometimes they're actually interesting, but other times, like, what is this?
Yeah.
What are some ways to really tell that? Because, you know, we're signing up for things all the time with emails. They require an email to do anything nowadays. And I guess we'll get a ton of, not spam, but just business emails.
Yeah.
Advertising, yes. Like, how are we supposed to tell that from something that is malicious?
That is another good question. And that just really takes like a kind of a keen eye, I would say, and it unfortunately does take time to where I end up learning what is malicious or what is not. One thing that you can wind up doing is at the top of the email, there's usually it says who the sender is, and you can look into there and actually see the email address it's coming from. And if it looks like it's, you know, random letters, numbers, characters in there, then it could potentially be a phishing attack that's being sent against your account there. Alternatively, if it's just something that you don't want to receive anymore, majority of email service providers allow you to mark it as spam, so it will actually go into a spam folder and you won't ever have to worry about seeing those kinds of things again. Other option too is at the bottom of the email there's usually an unsubscribe link. If you believe that it's actually a legitimate email from the marketing department of like Lowe's or whomever, then you can click on that unsubscribe and it will actually have to go through an unsubscribe process. You can unsubscribe from all the various marketing emails but still receive the emails that you want to receive via that pertain to your account information with them, or be able to tweak how the frequency, things along those lines as well. The other option too is to be able to do a, you have to do a search for it, but you know, search for, you know, whoever the the marketer is. So if it's Lowe's or Home Depot, whoever, email preferences or email settings, and be able to go into find those kinds of options there and be able to tweak those.
So this actually had me think of something because I've had, I don't know, like 10, 13 texts, all from USPS and text messages, not even emails, text messages. It's like, my package has been wrong address or something. Call this number and do that. So from what it sounds very similar to what you're talking about here. This isn't limited to email, is it?
It's not limited to email. So email, we usually there's the there's the word that we use is phishing. It's a phishing, phishing. There's also voice or phone calls, which is vishing. And then there's text messaging or SMS that we will call smishing.
Okay.
So it can come in any variety and shape, way, form here. Usually with vishing or, you know, someone calling you and trying to get your information, they will claim to be from Social Security office. They'll claim to be from the IRS. They're going to claim to be from any other kind of legitimate government service that's out there, you know, acting as though they are in a high authority to try and get your information. And that's really what they're going after, is your personal identifiable information, or PII, your name, your address, date of birth, social security number, possibly also credit card or something along those lines. And then with the SMS, they're doing the exact same thing, where they're trying to get you to click on a link to download some sort of malware or something like that onto your phone, phone, tablet, what have you. Or they're trying to get you to call them or engage with them in some shape, way, or form. I've received them as well. So not only am I a member here at the Kenosha Public Library, but I also serve, I was appointed by the governor to the Council of Library and Network Development. And one thing that I wound up receiving not too long ago was a text message claiming to be the superintendent of the state, requesting that I buy a bunch of gift cards for a party. And being the individual that I am, they texted me while I was actually on vacation. And I replied back saying, "Well, if you really want me to buy these gift cards, I'm going to need a forward on my allowance for purchasing," and then sent them a money request via Venmo.
Did you get it?
I did not, unfortunately.
So, oh God, how do they know that you might actually have that, like, contact now? Like, how do they even get that sort of info that fast?
So, usually what I have not received one that is this sophisticated yet, or before, prior to this. Usually what I have received are similar things like what you've received, where it's just like generic United States Postal Service or UPS or FedEx, something like that, or Amazon even, where they will just, you know, they're just going through all the possible phone numbers out there, you know, starting from 111111111111 all the way up to all nines, right? And they're just spamming each one with this kind of text message, and hoping what first that their message gets through, which, you know, there's some loophole, there's some hoops you got to jump through in order to get a text message out now, especially if you're going to do any kind of mass marketing like that. And then, two, hoping that, you know, maybe you're expecting a package and what have you. So they're just really playing the odds is all it is. So someone will eventually click on this or call them or answer the phone, what have you. So yeah, it's usually what I wind up seeing is, that's what you're going to wind up seeing a lot of, is more of the generic ones. Something that's this more sophisticated, this winds up happening because you've actually had to put your information out there online, because I used to actually be a consultant on the side, where I would do consulting work for various other state libraries around the nation, helping them out with automation and other practices like that. Instead of having like a separate phone number out there, which I really should have done, my cell phone number was out there. So it's one of those where, yeah, it's a that's how they were able to get my information. Then that links back to my LinkedIn account, and you're able to see exactly what I do on there, because LinkedIn's nothing more than, you know, really a online resume of sorts. So they can see that, oh, you do this now, I see. And then, so it was a very sophisticated attack that I still am on occasion just kind of shocked of how much time someone had to have spent to do this to try and come after me.
So there are two key takeaways I've been getting from that just story. One of the first ones is it's not always my fault. Like that, no. There's just all these things coming in, like it feels like USPS is gonna send someone to track me down at this point.
Yeah.
Because there's so many, they really don't want that package at their holding facility. Yeah. Whatever that's called. But it's not necessarily my fault or anyone listening's fault that they keep getting these spam, phishing, smishing. It's just someone trying to make a buck at the end of the day.
Really, it is. They're going through it through, unfortunately, nefarious means there, but that's what it comes down to. So they're just trying to get some money at the end of the day, and they're obviously able to get a large enough amount to be able to justify the costs and expenses to continue operating in this fashion, unfortunately. And also, those that are less tech savvy or tech knowledgeable are our most vulnerable victims out there.
And so the second thing is, you know, those very credible, it seems credible that you would have gotten a message like that. Somewhat.
Yeah.
But they had to find your information first to even know how to send that sophisticated of a message. And that's kind of telling me whenever we're putting our information online, yeah, someone might access that and use it for these kinds of purposes. Yes. Like user mentioned, had the cell phone, had your name, which could connect you to your LinkedIn, which then tells you, you know, what you're doing now. Mm-hmm. And because you want that public, but at the same time, there's a balance risk there. Yeah. Whenever you put information about yourself, it seems, at least on the internet.
Yes, there really is, unfortunately, and there's a and that's a, you know, that's a balance that I was, or a risk I was willing to take when I was doing all this originally. So I do take onus of some of that there as well, also, but also knowing too that, you know, I would see these potential types of attacks as well. If I were to do it over again, I probably would have created some sort of a secondary VoIP or voiceover IP internet-based phone messaging system, so someone could have called, left a voicemail, I would have just called them back potentially, just so I would have one less thing to have to worry about later on in life. But hindsight's always 20/20 there, as they like to say. So
yeah. Well, Rob, thank you for coming on the show again.
Thank you for having me.